listeners. This is Shannon Scott coming to you from deep inside of America's most haunted city, Savannah, Georgia. I welcome you to another entertaining episode of Truth Seeker Radio here on the Sixth Sense World Radio Network. We're having a plush spring, and with St. Patrick's Day happening just next week, the fountains are already running green, and soon the street shall be full of paraders and a million visitors, all wishing they could be just like us, living here year-round. Less the pollen, of course. Tonight I have such a treat for you as I introduce you to native Savannian, but citizen of the world, Murray Silver Jr. And I might add, this guy is a hero to storytellers from here to Tibet, literally. Naturally, I count myself among them, especially because so many of my heroes are dead. This guy is still 6 feet above, and that's a good thing, because trying to interview the dead is such a bitch, especially if they're in a bad mood. Murray Silver Jr. is perhaps best known to the world for befriending Jerry Lee Lewis and co-writing with his then-wife Myra, who, yeah, was the former 13-year-old bride of the killer, the international bestseller Great Balls of Fire, the uncensored story of Jerry Lee Lewis. And of course, as some of you may remember, there was a subsequent feature film starring Dennis Quaid as Jerry Lee and then Winona Ryder as Myra. And speaking of young, when Murray himself was just 16, he became the first person in history to book Fleetwood Mac. And as time went on, he found himself a major rock and roll photographer and writer. For example, he was the exclusive photog of the Wings tour with Paul and Linda McCartney. No small feat. And some say he took more photos of Elton John at his height than any other one snapshot artist. And for me, a personal favorite is that he rode the bus with the Sex Pistols during their breakup tour. He has very candid photos that are so cool of Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious. Yes, it gets no more rock and roll than Murray Silver Jr., my friends. And, you know, to add to his resume, his impressive billing, it was not too many years ago that he landed the role as personal tour organizer and assistant to the Dalai Lama. Hello. Which leads me to this thought, dear listeners. When we speak of Murray Silver Jr., it really does come down to a spirit who has moved in many, many worlds, taken on many forms, and always seems to be the man in the right place at the right time, and yeah, he always has a camera and a pen. And best part of all, I get to call him friend, which is why there is no way we can pack it all into one sitting, and I'm hoping this interview will be the hallmark to many others that follow. And although we generally go for an hour at a time, tonight, we're just going to push the record button and let it ride like rock and roll. So sit back, crack a brew, whatever it is that you do, and enjoy some silvery talk with me and Murray Silver Jr.
Hot seat, Murray Silver Jr. Nice to have you. St. Patrick's Day, soon to be here. The green fountains, green people, green pasties on women's breasts, all kinds of stuff. So, are you going to be in the parade this year?
I am. In fact, you'll see me three times. I'll be at the front of the parade, an adjutant in the white jacket. We're the guys that put the show on the road. And then I'll be marching as the High Leprechaun of the Shenanigans Society. And then I'll be bringing up the rear of the parade with the adjutant staff. We bring up the rear when the parade is over.
Wow.
And so I will, if you see, yeah, three times around from me this
wow.
year. I'm all about the green. My great-grandmother was a McCabe, so I'm fully 25% Irish.
Wow. I'll be working, doing tours that day, but I hope to see the parade part. So, you were born at the Telfair Hospital on Forsyth Park, which is now the home for some indigent, and you said that your birth sign was Libra, and your birth date was what exactly?
3 October.
3 October. And how do you feel connected to that birth sign, or how do you feel like it would come to define you?
Well, the thing about Librans that most people don't understand is that just because the sign is represented by the scales, it doesn't mean that we're in balance. It means that we're seeking balance. And that has always been the problem in my life, because I've always been an all-or-nothing kind of person. And for me to keep the wagon in the middle of the road has been the greatest challenge. In fact, to keep it on the road at all. And I'm the kind of guy that if I come to the proverbial fork in the road, invariably I always take the road less traveled, and that makes all the difference. But that being said, the thing too about Librans, I'm aware of other people who are Libran, And it was always important to me that John Lennon's birthday and mine were just a few days apart, because I was big about the Beatles and I identified very strongly with John Lennon. I knew the man. I worked with the man. In fact, I'd asked him to write the introduction to my first book. And so I've always felt a special connection with other Librans.
I see. And to that question, or to that definition, yeah, the John Lennon stuff fascinating. We'll come to that at some point. But was there any famous person born also on your birthday?
No, not on the 3rd that I'm aware of.
That you're aware of, okay. And what was your earliest childhood memory?
I remember when I was 4 years old, 1957, and I remember in the backyard of the house that we lived in on Abercorn and Durin, when Durin was a dirt road. And I remember being in the backyard on a summer day, and I was wearing short pants and a t-shirt, and I was barefoot standing on a cinder block. And I had a blue popsicle, and I was looking at the sky. And all of a sudden, I was keenly aware of myself. And I looked up the sky and I realized that I was alive and that I would not always be. And something is like the big light clicked on at that moment. And it was almost as if consciousness, the switch had been turned on. And I remember being ever present since that time. I don't have any recollections before that day or that moment, but I remember when that one kicked in.
I understand. Very good. Who was the first girl you kissed?
The next door neighbor at that same location. Her name was Vicki Hall. And there's an old home movie of me chasing her around in the front yard and catching her.
Interesting. You know, and just this kind of just like flew into my brain.
A lot of his time on the phone talking to the members of the Rolling Stones. And he is still the patriarch of the movement. And here it is, 2016. Everybody else is dead and gone. I mean, even right. Bowie is dead. All I know.
Yeah, that's it. As long as he can do that. Okay.
I play a certain instrument. And that's why I never played professionally, although I would have had the chance, perfect chance to.
And did you ever in your lifetime see Cat Stevens play?
I did. I saw him when he first started. And I remember he... I saw the first couple of tours that he did, and in fact the last big arena tours that he did, and the odd thing is I remember he had a girlfriend who I've hooked up with later on. He was Patty Darbinville, the actress,
okay,
who was later married to Don Johnson, and okay, who comes to the Savannah Film Festival all the time.
Okay.
Patty Darbinville used to date Cat Stevens, and for her, he wrote the song Lady Darbinville.
Mm.
And I met her back in the early 70s and didn't see her again until we hooked up at the Savannah College of Art and Design Film Festival downtown. Shows you how small this world is.
That is
Talk
wild.
About wild world, Cat.
That's
wild
it.
Wild world, small world.
That is crazy.
Yeah, man.
I've seen that photograph or those photos of you all two hanging out here in Savannah.
Yeah.
Who was your favorite teacher in grade school?
Mrs. Mims, who taught me in the 4th and 5th grade, and this was 63-64, Jacob G. Smith.
Oh, Jacob G. Yeah, I used to cater some lunches there when I ran a deli.
I still live across the street from there.
Oh, okay. Is Bob Strozier still around?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Yeah, I know he lived over there, too. So, what was the... You had mentioned something about bringing the Beatles album into one of your classes. Was that Mrs. Mims?
Yeah, that's why I remember that so vividly. I remember the first time the Beatles played Ed Sullivan, right after John F. Kennedy had been murdered. The whole country was bummed out, and then the Beatles played Ed Sullivan, and all of a sudden, you know, we got back to living. And I remember watching that performance and wanting to go back to school the next day to ask my classmates if they had seen the Beatles on that song. And if you didn't, you missed it, because this is big and this is important. And it was so important that my dad bought me their first album called Meet the Beatles. And Mrs. Mims would allow me to play an entire side for the class on Friday afternoon at the end of the school day. And you know, I was like a celebrity because I'm now the class's Ed Sullivan. In fact, I used to do an impersonation of Ed Sullivan, and I would bring out the Beatles and the whole nine. And to this day, I have classmates from back then who vividly remember my introducing them to the Beatles. Not because they didn't see Ed Sullivan, but they remember I introduced them to the Beatles.
I love it. Now, you mentioned that when you were a young kid and your dad was struggling as an attorney, he basically got his attorney's license the day you were born, correct?
Right.
And so there he was, the 24-year-old young father, I can't even imagine that, trying to figure out how to make a living, make a dollar. And so he and a relative of yours decided to start bringing some acts to town?
My father was dear friends with the immortal Buster White. Okay. Who for 50 years was Savannah's preeminent promoter of not only musical events and theatrical events, but sporting events. This is the guy who brought Sugar Ray Robinson to town three times to box, once at the beginning of his career, once in the middle, once in the end. Buster White, parenthetically, brought the Beatles to Atlanta. Buster White, for 50 years, booked wrestling, boxing in Savannah. He booked Broadway shows. He brought everything to Savannah. And every so often, he would partner with my dad. They would go in together on something risky or something that, you know, they weren't sure if they were going to make any money or not. And my father, being a lawyer, would sometimes handle the contracts and stuff like that. So that's how my father got involved in the concert promotion business in the 50s when I was a little fella.
Wow.
And one of my earliest memories is I remember in 57, he took me to see Little Brenda Lee. And I think I was 4 years old. And I sat on my father's shoulders and watched the show. And shortly after that, my dad brought Connie Francis to Savannah. And I had a massive crush on Connie Francis. I used to smooch her picture on the album cover. And my mother.
Four?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. Well, I've already told you about that first kiss with Vicky. But my mother took me downtown to meet Connie Francis. She was doing a rehearsal.
Wow.
And Connie tried to kiss me. And I ran and hid behind my mother. And I was just petrified.
Oh,
but
God.
I remember running and hiding behind my mother so that Connie Francis wouldn't kiss me.
So she never got to lay one on you?
No, but I'll tell you something weird. About 50 years later, I'd called Connie Francis because she was looking for someone to write a book with her, and I reminded her of this, and of course she said, no, I don't remember. So obviously it did not make
apparently,
as big an impression on Connie as it made on me.
Apparently she did not have the hots for you.
I don't know why Connie doesn't remember that, but
that's profound. Obviously, you know, for you it was major. Now, what year did Elvis play here in Savannah?
56.
56. And you were, okay, so you were.
He right played here right before he played Ed Sullivan. He played it right before he hit it big.
The old Civic Center.
And people here, you know, a lot of people didn't know who he was or they didn't care.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny is I have a copy of an article. It's actually online that my friend Dee Sutliv from Savannah, she wrote it for the Savannah Morning News when she was 13, I think, maybe 12. She was basically asked as a young girl to review the Elvis concert here. And she used a phrase in the article to this day that I don't know where it comes from, but it cracks me up. She said that Elvis was the gonest.
The gonest.
The gonest. He was so gone.
He was the gonest,
man. He was the king of the gonest.
I can't argue with that.
The king of the gone, man.
I can't argue with that. There's a story that most people are not aware of is the fact that before the Beatles played Jacksonville, they had dinner here in Savannah, Georgia, because a hurricane had blown through, changed their travel plans. They were stranded in Savannah the night before the show, and they had dinner upstairs at Ganem's in the old Rebel Room.
No kidding.
In one of the booths.
The Beatles.
The Beatles. Well, three of them. Ringo wasn't with them. Ringo was sick. But three of them had dinner at Ganem's. And if you go by and talk to Charlie, they'll tell you that they vividly remember that story.
Wow.
The Beatles.
Now, that brings to mind, as you probably noted, maybe in the past 5 years or less, they discovered those previously unfound photos of the Rolling Stones staying out at the Thunderbird
Inn
Highway 17,
cool.
Beachy Road in Savannah. Do you have any recollection of that that show that they did at Georgia Southern University?
I didn't like the Rolling Stones because you got to remember, you were either a Beatle dude or you were a Stone dude. You could not like both of them.
Yeah.
You could not. And you know why? Magazines used to promote this thing in order to sell the teen magazines.
Yeah.
It was like, Beatles versus the Stones and who's the cutest and who's the best. And you had to choose, man. It was like electing president. You're either going to vote for Kennedy or Nixon, but you can't like both. And so I was a Beatle dude. I didn't like the Stones. I hated the Stones. I did not nothing Stone. Not until I did their tour in 75 did I have anything to do with the Stones.
Gotcha.
Because it was disloyal to the Beatles to be a fan of the Stones.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think that I don't know if that tradition continues so much today because the magazine thing is really gone. It's all the internet. But yeah, like in the 80s, I remember, you know, the magazine still tried to have that rivalry thing, you know, going on. Like, for me, it was like, you know, you were either a fan of The Cure or you were a fan of Echo and the Bunnymen. Like, Ian McCullough and Robert Smith, you couldn't, you know.
Well, you know, yeah. it was like the either you like the Partridge Family or you like the Cassidys or, I mean, you had to choose. You couldn't like both, you
your
know.
Favorite team, your favorite
that
team.
Marketing thing, but your yeah, I was always on the Beatle team.
Wow. So you, we kind of touched on the subject earlier that, you know, or I asked you anyway about Savannah being an otherworldly place, and then you kind of. I think you talked a little bit about your mother. You kind of broached the subject with your mother that you had a sense of maybe the extrasensory, and that your mother, as a child, didn't like lambast you or tell you that was silly, but she actually kind of made you feel, I don't know, invited into that or welcome to that.
Well, the difference was that my mother's family had been very close to Edgar Cayce, mm-hmm. who was America's first great psychic. And from time to time, you still see his name on the cover of tabloids because some prophecy he foretold 60 years ago is coming true today. He's considered to be the father of the new age, if you will. And there's an institute dedicated to his work in Virginia Beach
mm-hmm.
and preserves 20,000 of his psychic readings. But my mother's family put him into business.
Okay.
You know, Edgar was a poor kid that came out of the woods of Kentucky. And my mother's people were very wealthy people living in Lexington, Kentucky. And Edgar's first readings were for friends of my great-grandmother.
Okay.
And basically, the reason people would come and see him was to solve some sort of a health problem that doctors couldn't get on top of.
Okay.
Edgar Cayce is who you went to if you had some mysterious illness and the doctors didn't know what this was. And then what he would do was he would meet you. He would lay down and take a nap and diagnose you. That's why they called him the sleeping prophet.
Right.
Edgar only got his messages from the universe by taking a nap.
Yeah.
So he'd go to sleep on you, and then he would wake up with the answer.
Mm.
And so my great-grandmother used to book things. And here's what happened. Edgar, being a poor man and could not read for himself, Edgar Cayce could not tell you what he was going to have for lunch today. He could tell you what was going to happen to you for the next 50 years, but he couldn't tell you anything about himself.
Interesting.
So what he would do was he would give my mother's family advice on investments.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And with that money, they took care of Edgar.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the arrangement.
Wow.
And my uncle, my great uncle, Dave Kahn, wrote one of the first books about Edgar Cayce, simply called My Life with Edgar Cayce. And it was published in the early 60s. And tells the story about how my mother's family put Edgar Cayce into business.
Mm.
So when I started telling my mother that I could see and speak to spirit, my mother didn't tell me that's ridiculous.
Mm.
Because my mother had grown up in that environment. And it was accepted, it was understood.
Wow, that's really, really a different childhood, different family culture. I'm curious, did your mother ever meet him?
My mother never met Edgar Cayce, but her mother did, and her aunts and uncles, grandparents, naturally. But this was her father, and he was from Kentucky, and my mother's people are all here in Savannah.
Yeah.
So it's through my mother's father that she has the connection to Cayce.
I've always had a strong feeling that Edgar Cayce was very much like Nostradamus, that he was a legitimate guy. I just always have felt he was not a charlatan, but he was really just kind of in touch with some sort of, you know, power. I mean, especially like the sleep thing, that makes sense to me. Like, you know, you're kind of like in between the physical, the spiritual. I think it's amazing that he was able to harness that. Now, that's just my take on it. What do you think?
Well, he was also a connection to the other side, and then I remember that when my Uncle Dave died, the family had an experiment. They wanted Dave to contact them once he got to the other side. And there's the famous story that as the family had gathered around for a wake that they heard this incredible banging on the pipes, and it was Dave sending a message. And so Edgar was more than a prognosticator, and he was more than a prophet and a seer, you know, because, first of all, he came up, he's the father of an awful lot of remedies, home remedies and so forth, and the stuff that he was telling people to take 40 and 50, 60 years ago, you now buy it brighter day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the other thing about Edgar Cayce that a lot of people aren't aware of is that he used to read for sitting presidents of the United States.
Mm.
They would call him into the White House, and he would tell them what time it is. And a lot of people aren't aware of that. And you have to remember how sensitive that would have been, because a lot of people in America wouldn't have approved of that kind of witchcraft. But Edgar used to read for sitting presidents.
Mm.
So his ability was recognized high and low. But the thing was, what he specialized in was he had the ability to read you like an X-ray machine. And he could tell you what was wrong with you and why and what you could do to cure it. And the cure inevitably was nothing like you were going to get from the doctor. So I don't know what you call that. I don't know what you call that kind of person. You know, he's like
almost like homeopathic.
He's like a shaman.
Shaman, yeah. Like homeopathy, I mean. It's like an intuitive...
Yeah, but he was telling people to do stuff that doctors are saying, yeah, you do that, it'll kill you.
Yeah.
But it was working. That mm-hmm. was... I mean, he was like...
I've heard some stories that are pretty fascinating. Do you know... Was it ever expressed or discussed with you, like, via your mother, whether it was something profound he did for them?
Other than make them a fortune?
Yeah. Sure.
During hard times?
Yeah.
No. That's it.
Yeah, that's good.
He made them a fortune.
That's profound.
During,
Depression era.
Depression, yeah.
Wow. Amazing, amazing. Well, we're going to take just a little break here, gang, and we'll be right back. Yeah, we're here with Murray Silver. We got kind of cut off there for a second. But we were talking about your grandparents' record store and some of the neat things of your childhood and the influences of music. And you were being terrified by Connie Francis, even though you were in love with her album and always kissing the album. So let me ask you this. Did you ever play any instruments or sing or have that ambition?
Yeah, I sang in the choir at Mikveh Israel when I was a kid, and I sang in school. And I wanted to play the guitar like the Beatles, but I realized that I did not have any real ability. And in band, in school, I played the trumpet and the baritone and thoroughly enjoyed those days. But again, I didn't have a real proficiency on any instrument I ever took up. I only wanted to learn the instrument enough to play one or two songs.
Okay.
And I'm still like that today. In fact, I'm going to buy bagpipes just so I can play one or two songs on them. And the interesting thing is I take up an instrument just to learn something in particular, and then I'm done. And I remember when I was in college, I had the music to Cat Stevens's Tea for the Tillerman, and I learned to play all those songs, and then I seemed to be done with the guitar. But that's all I wanted to do was play like Cat Stevens, because at the time he was the dude.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, I don't have any real ability, which is why I never became a performer. I don't have any real ability. In other words, I can't think originally with a guitar. I can't write music. And I learned at an early point the difference.
Gotcha. So, let's see. Thinking here. Did Savannah, as a child, seem to you as otherworldly, or did it take going away to come back to have a sense of that as it being a... I mean, a home is special, but Savannah is definitely not every town in the USA. So were you kind of like keenly aware that it was a unique place, or...
Well, I'll tell you, when my father uprooted us, I was 12 years old, mm-hmm. and I must tell you, I took it extremely hard.
Okay.
And there was something about Savannah that I was aware on many different levels. First of all, like I said, both my mother's family and my father's family were here and had been here a long time. Everybody I ever knew was here. But more than that, it was the physical environment. You know, it was the beach, and it was the squares, and it was the oak trees, and it was the moss, and it was the ponies in back of Johnny Harris, and it was Johnny Harris, and it was things like that. And I remember, though, also as a child, being horribly terrified to drive past Colonial Cemetery, mm-hmm. if it was dark,
yeah,
because I was forever seeing things that I didn't want to see, and so consequently, I knew that Savannah was special and different because I had traveled as a kid to other places and knew that when I came home, I was coming back to something that didn't exist in other places because I had family in Florida. And after we moved to Atlanta, I was painfully aware of the difference. And when we moved from here in 65 down to Jekyll Island, I felt like we were living in exile. Now, we're living on an island, and I got the beach, but it's not the same as Tybee. And Brunswick is an old town and a seaport, but it's nothing like Savannah. And I was absolutely miserable in that place. Mm-hmm. I hated it. And I acted out in all sorts of ways, and I was terribly unhappy. And I never, ever, ever forgave my father for moving us away from Savannah. And I missed it with every beat of my heart until I finally got back here in 1998.
Gotcha. So you talked about being born at the Telfair on Forsyth Park, the Telfair Hospital, which is now like a home for the indigent, I believe.
I plan on dying there.
Okay.
In the same room I was born in.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, well, there's something poetic about it.
Fair enough, with like a Playboy bunny or two. You know, the Hugh Hefner fantasy. Now, so do you have any memories of, like, that end of Forsyth Park or playing in the park as a kid or, you know?
Well, I remember the old fort when it was the old fort. The thing that is now the coffee shop and where the fountain is and was actually built in order to teach Benedictine cadets how to storm a castle.
Right.
And I remember when I was...
And you're referring to the dummy fort.
The dummy fort. Yeah.
Middle of the park. It's now a cafe, coffee shop.
It was still being used for that, to teach boys rudimentary battle techniques. But the thing I remember most about that park was my dad, when I was a little boy, my dad was one of the founders of Little League Baseball in the 50s. My dad was one of a group of businessmen who went to local businesses like Starland Dairies and First Federal and got them to sponsor baseball teams. And they played in the park. And the backstop, it faced the Confederate Monument. And if a guy could hit the ball to the Confederate Monument, that's a home run. And I remember being the bat boy in 1957 for my dad's Little League team. And Kenny Harrelson played ball for my dad, who later went on to play pro ball and is now the voice of the White Sox. And so... my most vivid memories of the big park in the 50s were Little League Ball and BC Cadets.
Okay. Did you have any awareness of, I'm just kind of, you know, sidebarring here, but did you have any awareness of the morgue tunnel when you were a kid or no?
No, nothing. You're speaking of one of at Candler Hospital. I wasn't aware of it when I was a kid, but I'll tell you something else. I had a lot of experiences from very early on, and to me, they were not as frightening as it is to some people, if only because my mother was the perfect coach to handle the situation. My mother's family, after all, had been the benefactors of Edgar Casey. They had put Edgar Casey into business, and my mother's uncle, David Kahn, wrote one of the first books about Edgar Casey, and it was my... My mother's grandmother put Edgar Casey in business.
No kidding.
And so when I started telling my mother that I could see and speak to spirit, my mother didn't tell me I was imagining things. My mother said, well, let's talk about that.
I see.
And my mother would get on the phone to her people and Edgar's people and talk about what was going on with me.
Sure.
And so my mother never made me feel that I was weird or that this was something to be afraid of. My mother said, well, yeah. And she instead gave me books to read. And and that is what made all the difference.
Wow.
I did not learn to turn a blind eye to it as many children who will complain to the parents that they see something at night. And the parent comes in the room and says, oh, there's nothing in the closet. Go back to bed. And the child learns... Well, at some point, they don't trust themselves anymore because their parents are there imagining things.
Right.
And then they, as quote-unquote, turn a blind eye to it. You learn to tune the stuff out.
Sure.
To block it out. You don't see it because you don't want to see it. Well, right. Not me.
Right.
I'd see this stuff and say, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. There was a, for a while, there was a girl named Sarah Casey that lived here in Savannah. And she was a direct descendant of Edgar. When did he die? Do you remember?
Back in the 50s.
Probably about that. Okay. Wow. That's really interesting. Now, I don't want to totally jump ships here into the world of the psychic quite yet, but was your mother friendly to that because it ran in the family?
Yeah, because my mother remembers vividly when she was a little girl, one of her first experiences.
Mm-hmm.
She said she was in her nursery, and she said the moon came into her nursery, mm-hmm. and the moon had a face in it.
Okay.
This was an orb.
Okay.
And the next day told her mother that the moon and the man in the moon came into her nursery, and my mother never, ever, ever, ever forgot that. And she grew up in a house that doesn't exist anymore, sadly, but it was on the corner of Bull and 31st. It's now the parking lot to the church. But they grew a huge Victorian four stories, and my mother lived on the second floor. And she had been raised by her grandparents, my great-grandparents. And this house was absolutely unbelievable. It was like the Addams Family. And my great-grandparents had like eight children.
Uh-huh.
And everybody lived in this house, and there was an awful lot of stuff going on. And my mother remembers vividly her first experiences, which again, when I started having them, my mother said, well, yeah, let's talk about it.
Wow. We will definitely reroute back to that subject. So question, any siblings?
I have a brother 5 years my junior.
Okay. What is he doing in the world?
Nothing.
Okay.
He abdicated his life several years ago. He was a lawyer in my father's tradition,
uh-huh.
inherited the firm, was teaching law at Emory University, and one day decided he didn't want to do that anymore. And his wife had made a lot of money in a company that had gone public called MapQuest. And so when she came into MapQuest money, they decided to move back to her home in Pennsylvania, and I never saw him again.
I see. So they're...
He's gone.
Okay.
He's out. He doesn't want to be Eric Silver, you know. He wants to be Eric, but he's not one of us.
I see.
He's not.
Yeah. Well, you know, Khalil Gibran always, you know, in The Prophet, he talked about how parents are really kind of like portals for the spirits of their children, that the children come through them, but they can't really ultimately define them, completely control them. As much as, you know, maybe that's the love and temptation of a family, but some definitely go their own way, don't they? I mean, well beyond the herd or something.
I believe that we choose our parents, but I believe that it's because they set the stage for the life that we're supposed to have.
Yeah, sure.
And it sets you up both good and bad, pro and con, positives and negatives. But your parents, they set the stage for you. They don't necessarily give you the script, but they set the stage and they put you on it, and then boom, whatever you have blueprinted in your life then happens.
Okay.
If you're fortunate enough to remember the blueprint.
Uh-huh.
Many of us get lost along the way, and then you're in trouble. You're off script.
Mm-mm. For sure. Okay, well, let's see. Now, having read your father's book, Bo Peep, This Ain't No Fairy Tale, and your book, which I still consider the best storybook about Savannah, Behind the Moss Curtain. And, of course, learning things from our friendship. When I think of the Silver name and family, the word that I use to describe your clan to others, especially tourists that I'm talking to, that the Silvers are hustlers. Not so much the criminal version, but what I mean is that the Silvers are people who get things done, they know how to keep doing them, and make them a success. Mm. Would you agree with that analogy?
Mm. Yeah, I'm aware of the negative connotation, but the thing is this. I come from a long list of saints and sinners. And here's the thing about the Silvers, though. It doesn't end well for any of us.
Mm. Mm.
It doesn't end well for any. It didn't end well for my grandfather, who took his own life in 1963. It didn't end well for my father, who was disbarred from the practice of law and left town shortly thereafter. It didn't end well for my Uncle Julian. And it doesn't end well for the Silvers. And I've noticed in Savannah, Georgia, the fascinating thing is that there are many families here that they come here as immigrants in one generation. They make a lot of money. And then the next generation benefits and goes to college, maybe becomes doctors and lawyers. And then the following generation will squander it. And it's amazing to me how many once prominent families that I knew in the 50s and the 60s, where the next, the second and third generations undo it all. They end up dead by mischance. They end up broke. They end up broken. They end up in jail. They end up gone. But it's a fascinating thing. It doesn't end well for a lot of Savannah families. And that's why I decided to write a book like Behind the Moss Curtain, because I realized there were a lot of great stories buried in Bonaventure Cemetery. And I wanted to dig them up again. And I thought, well, my family was no different in that regard. And what is amazing to me is that there are a lot of prominent Savannah families that have had tragedy.
Yeah, sure.
And when I was a little boy growing up in Bacon Park, did you know that there was like, throughout Bacon Park, for every house, it was almost biblical, like that Egyptian plague thing. There was a child who died in almost every house.
Wow.
Jimmy Pappy, John Heffernan, Billy Duncan, Freddie Weiss, Miriam Sinner's son. It was unbelievable.
Now, were they different ages, or were they young?
These were all young kids.
They were friends of yours?
And it was tragic what was happening to Savannah families.
Wow.
And I was going to write a book about that, but I thought it would upset far too many people and decided against it. But at one point in time, Albert Weiss, who owned the theaters, is next door to Tony Heffernan, the prominent physician.
Yeah.
Both of their sons are dead before they're 17 years old.
Oh.
Phenomenal stuff going on in Savannah. And Jimmy Pappy, who lived next door to them, unbelievable what was happening to Savannah kids.
So it's fair to say you learned a lot about mortality early.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let's see. There's so much to talk about. Tell me about your great-grandparents on your father's side. They were Polish, were they not? And how did they migrate to Savannah? They went to New York.
My great-grandparents on my father's side, Bo Peep's parents, Polish Jews, had lived in London for a couple of years. Bo Peep was an infant when they come to the United States by boat, and the boat sinks.
Oh, my God.
Boat sinks, and my great-grandfather and his brother are separated. Now, at the time, the family's name is Amdursky.
Okay.
And
that's quite a name.
Yeah, and so the Amderskys are separated. They are rescued by different boats. They come to the United States in different places.
Mm.
My great-grandfather comes to Savannah, Georgia, and he's going through the immigration process, and they turn to him and say, "What is your name?" And he looks up and he sees a signboard for the Silver Coffee Company. He said, "My name is Silver." Now, his brother, meanwhile in New York, has come through Ellis Island, and he tells the people that his name is Amder. He wants to drop the S-K-I. He doesn't want that. So he says, "My name is Amder." So today I've got cousins named Amder, and then there's the Silvers. But that's how my father's people came here. They came here by boat. The boat sank, and this is right at the turn of the last century.
Wow, that's like a classic reach the American precipice story there.
Yeah,
you know, some accidentalism and fate.
They had a little corner grocery on Williamson Street, a half a block off of River.
Okay. It's now the pool to the motel.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a photograph of my grandfather standing on that corner in front of that building. The downstairs was a corner store. They lived upstairs. The building long since gone, but I have a photograph that establishes the Silvers on that street corner. Williamson, half a block off the river, and that's where they own this corner grocery.
Wow.
Bo Peep had to quit the third grade to shine shoes to help him make money.
Wow.
And then became a bootlegger during Prohibition.
Right. And let's come back to that, but... my mama, and then the great grandparents are out there in Bonaventure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see them routinely on my tours.
Give them Aragon.
Yeah, well. Okay. As long as I've been, kind of to that point, as long as I've been here in Savannah, some 25 years plus, for most of that anyway, the building at Barnard and Broughton Street always bore the words Silver 5 and 10 wrapped around two sides of it. Did you have mixed feelings when J. Crew came in and put their corporate mall logo up instead?
Well, I'll tell you what. Before that, when Jan van Blanken was occupying that space with Clipper Trading, he wanted to change the face of the building, and the city said, no, that is a historic facade.
Exactly.
You cannot touch it.
Which is why it
you
shocked me.
You cannot change it. You cannot. And he came to me, said, can I get your permission? Will you go before council and the Board of Historic Review and tell them that you're okay with changing it? I said, would you do that for me? I said, you know what? It won't make any difference. They're not going to change it. It's ironclad in stone.
Yeah.
And when when this guy comes to town, what's his name?
Ben
Carter comes to town and waves the checkbook around. He can make it rain.
Wow.
And I'll never forget. Nobody called and told me, but when the sign came down, I went, what? Oh, what? Sorry. Wait. And well, first of all, I wanted the sign. And I couldn't even get the sign. The sign disappeared.
Wow.
But the thing is that nobody said, no. Welcome to Savannah.
Yeah. Well, it's probably for sale at 24E. for like $10,000, you know, installments now.
I'll have to ask Rule about
that.
Yeah,
get a credit app. He'll sell you back as your own son.
Speaking of which,
yeah,
the house that all of my childhood memories are stored in on Washington Avenue,
yeah,
my grandparents sold in 1960-something for like $13,000.
Yeah.
It's now on the market for $1 million.
Good God.
And I'm sorry that they didn't leave that to me, because that is the place I want more than any other. And I don't think I'll be buying that back in this lifetime.
No doubt, no doubt. Now, back to that building that is currently the J. Crew store,
yeah,
which baffles me. But how did that come into being? And do you have memories of that place and the activities there?
Well, it was just, you know, an outgrowth of that corner grocery store that got too big for itself. And then they moved down to Broughton Street, and it was not really banging when I was old enough to remember it. I remember Woolworths and Cress's, but I don't remember Silver's. And I do remember this, though, that only because people reminded me. There is a woman in this town that I met during my mayoral campaign last year, a black woman, who said to me, my family still includes your family in our prayers because your great-grandfather hired my grandmother to work behind the counter when there weren't any other black women in town working behind a counter on Broughton Street. She said he was the first.
Wow.
And we still include him in our prayers.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
Yeah, he, you know, this is a guy who back in the day put a black woman behind a sales counter.
Wow, that's great.
Because long before you even saw black people on Broughton Street for any
sure
reason, because their main street was West Broad.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Now they say high school defines a lot of people. What stands out to you when you think of that time, high school?
I went to high school in Atlanta, Georgia, and I graduated in 71, and it was a remarkable group of people.
Several what high school did you go to?
Lakeside.
Is that still there?
Is. It's one of the finest schools in Georgia. And my senior year, we won the state championship in most sports. And I remember I went to school with some exceptional people, and several of them are still my closest friends today. And but the thing was about Atlanta was it was very, very different from Savannah. And again, I had a hard time adjusting. My father moved us up there when I was in the ninth grade. And it was a couple of years before I could fit in. But some of those people are my best friends to this day.
Okay. And what part of town did you live in?
Northeast Atlanta, inside the Perimeter Highway, not far from North Lake Mall.
Okay. Now, so was that just considered Atlanta at the time?
It was the outskirts. I got to tell you, when my father bought this house in 1970, there was no Perimeter Highway.
Yeah.
This was before North Lake Mall. This is when, if you went a couple miles down the road, you were in another town called Tucker.
Yeah, sure.
And beyond that was Civil War battlefields and Stone Mountain, which used to take you all day to drive to because you had to take these two-lane little dirt roads to get out to Stone Mountain. So Atlanta in 1970 was a far different Atlanta than the one today.
For real.
But my father bought this house in 1970, $50,000, two-story red brick house. And that house right now is a $500,000 home. But the thing is that $50,000, 1970, in a subdivision that was considered to be, you know, a bucolic setting.
Yeah.
This is on the outskirts of town, man.
Yeah.
And like I say, 285 hadn't even been built yet.
Yeah.
So there was just nothing.
Right.
There was farms out there.
Right, right. So now, were you, just curious, I mean, were you involved in athletics at all? Were you a sports person at all?
I had no physical ability.
Did you like sports? I mean, obviously you like sports. You followed baseball.
I did, but a bizarre thing happened to me at some point, and I had a real aversion to the locker room experience.
Okay.
And I faked an injury that kept me out of physical ed.
Okay.
And you got to remember, I would go home and play ball the livelong day and loved it, but there was something about, and I can't explain what it is. I can't, and to this day, I've never really gotten to the bottom of it, but in school, I did not excel in. In fact, I didn't excel in anything.
Gotcha.
But yet, I was elected by my classmates outstanding senior in 71, not having excelled at anything except having brought some concerts to town.
Uh-huh. And that takes us to our next subject. Now, a little earlier, you and I were talking a little bit about how, when you were, I'm not sure, what grade were you in when you brought the Beatles album to class?
Fourth, fifth grade.
Fourth grade, you brought the Beatles album to class, and you were really excited about that. And even your friends today still talk to you about the time you brought the Beatles album to class, which is just awesome. So, you know, music immediately grabbed onto you. You grabbed onto it. Mm. But is it true that when you were 16 that you booked Fleetwood Mac?
True.
Okay.
Can prove it. I got the posters and the newspaper articles.
Now, were you literally the first person ever?
First.
Okay. And how did that all come to be?
1969. I was 16 years old. We were living in Atlanta. My father was a lawyer. He had just left the Georgia Department of Labor. He was Martin Luther King's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, I remember in 69, Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to my father, you know, if there's hundreds of thousands of hippies, will go sit down in the field for 3 days in the heat and the rain to listen to this music. And chances are they'd be willing to pay $3 to go downtown and sit in a theater and listen to the same music. And I told my father, I said, there isn't anyone in Atlanta promoting concerts. And my father was the kind of guy who was, he would always say to me, look, do it. Just do it. Just whatever it is that you want to do it. Don't sit there and talk about it. Do it. I said, well, do what? He said, well, pick up a phone, call somebody. I said, call who? He said, call New York. Call New York. Call, find out somebody who books bands. There's people in New York, there's talent, they book bands. You call New York, and you find out who books, and let's do it. So one afternoon, I'm 16 years old, one afternoon, I pick up the phone, and I call Long Distance Operator New York. They used to have that, ladies and gentlemen. And I said to the operator, can you hook me up with a company that books bands? And she said, 1 minute, please. And she books me up with the first people she found, the CAA company. And the phone directly, she puts the call in.
Yeah, yeah. And, so the operator hooks
and,
you
up. And a guy named Joe Lambusta picks up the phone. Creative artist Joe Lambusta picks up the phone. And all of a sudden, for some reason, I thought that maybe I shouldn't be me. Maybe I should be my father. Now, you got to remember, my father and I have the same name.
Yeah,
I'm a junior.
Right,
and so I said, Hello, this is Murray Silver calling from... I'm an attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm calling because I'd like to book bands. And the guy goes, great, what beautiful. Listen, we think Atlanta is ready to explode. Terrific. We don't have anybody down there booking acts and counsel. This is terrific. And he said, who do you want? I said, yes, I'd like the Rolling Stones, please. And he said, no, man. You don't just order the Rolling Stones like a pizza. Shoot. You have to earn the Stones. We have to have a relationship with you first. Besides, he said, they're not on tour. And I said, well, who do you have then? And he said, okay, now you're talking. And he said to me, and I'll never forget it, he said, we got a brand new band out of England. Just recorded their first album. They're called Fleetwood Mac. I said, I never heard of them. He said, right. They're very big in England. He said, and they're going to be very big here. He said, tell you what, I'll send you the album. I'll send you the press kit and photographs. He said, listen to it. Tell me what you think.
Wow.
And I said, who else do you have? He said, well, we've got another brand new band out of California called Grand Funk Railroad.
Hell yeah.
They've just recorded their first album called On Time. I said, I've never heard of them. And he said, of course you haven't. He said, but they're going to be big. He said, tell you what, I'll put both albums in the envelope. I'll send it to you and a contract. He said, I'll give you both bands. I'll give you a deal. You get both bands $5,000. I said, well, oh. So a package arrives from Murray Silver.
Yeah.
And it's two albums and photographs and a contract. And I'm playing the albums. And my father comes home from the office one day and he says, what is that? I said, well, you remember you told me to, you remember what you said to call that? I said, well, I did. And this is what he sent me. He goes, you know, that sounds like something. I said, you know, Dad, these guys are huge in England. He goes, yeah, sounds like something. And I said, well, Dad, they sent me a contract. He goes, yeah. Yeah, well, show it to me. And my father got the contract, and at the time, if you were going to book somebody, you sent in a check for half of the amount.
Yep.
You get the date, and then at the show, you give them the remainder of the money.
Yeah.
So my father says, well, $2,500. He said, look, that's all the money I got. Wow. I said, well, Dad, I said, look, I said, you know something. I said, you know, Dad, there's 2,000 kids go to my high school. At $3 a ticket, that's $6,000. We could easily get our money back and make some money here. He goes, yeah. 2,000 kids, $3, that's $6,000. That's yeah. He said, now you're sure? I said, Dad, I'm telling you, it's crazy.
And you tried to avoid saying P.T. Barnum once said.
Well, the problem was that, first of all, I forgot that you had to find a place to have the concert. And at the time in Atlanta, Georgia, there was only one place, and it was the old Civic Auditorium downtown,
right,
which was one of the few buildings that Sherman didn't burn down.
Yeah, sure.
And so it's sitting there, and I went to the city, and the city said, no, we don't allow rock and roll acts on the city stage. No. And I thought, I didn't know what to do at this point, but I had a cousin that was going to Oglethorpe College, and Oglethorpe had a field house, which you could use for concerts.
Wow.
It's where they play basketball. And my cousin was Jay Kaminsky, who was the famous car dealer here in Savannah at Southern Motors.
Yeah. Right.
So Jay was in college at the time, and he said, look, he said, I can set you up at Oglethorpe. He said, it'd be cool, and we can sell a bunch of tickets. And so, long story short, we take the deal. December 10th, 1969, Oglethorpe Fieldhouse, Atlanta, Georgia, Grand Funk Railroad, Fleetwood Mac, tickets $350. I'm selling the tickets in the lunchroom at Lakeside High School, and no one is buying tickets because they had never heard of Fleetwood Mac or Grand Funk. And I want to remind you, 69, there were no FM radio stations.
No.
You couldn't hear this music on the radio.
Sure.
The only thing on radio was top 10 and pop music and, you know, the top pop 40, but there was no underground music, no FM stations. And the only way you could hear this music is if you went to a record store that was really hip and you knew the guy, and the guy turned you on to import records or the really cool stuff that's coming out of New York and L.A. But the thing is that none of the kids I'm going to school – I mean, the kids I was going to school with, they were all into the Temptations, okay?
Yeah, okay.
They were into Blood, Sweat, and Tears in Chicago. They never heard of Fleetwood Mac and Grand Funk Railroad. So the bottom line was they weren't buying the tickets. And the night of the show, I didn't have the money to pay the bands. And much to my surprise, I didn't sell any tickets. And then when I went in to start the show, the place was packed with people that had all snuck in the back door.
Oh!
Yeah, Oglethorpe students knew that there was a back door. I didn't know. And like a schmuck, I walk in. The place is packed with people. And I literally did not know what to do. I did not know what to... All of these people had snuck in, and they didn't have tickets. And yet now it's time to start the show. And boom, before I know it, Fleetwood Mac, Grand Funk Railroad is on. So,
is that what they call rock and roll?
That's what they call...
You're the ringmaster of stupid all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I love it, man. I love it.
That was the very first show that I booked was Grand Funk Railroad. And to this day, Mick Fleetwood has never forgotten that because I couldn't pay him. And he said to me, he said, well, you're the first show in the tour. And we don't have any money.
Right, and there was some story about them spending the night with you, right?
They had nowhere else to go. They couldn't pay the hotel bill.
Right. So they came to stay with you and said, your dad,
your parents? You're going to have to pay us, so we can't get to the Chicago.
Right.
And so I had to go back to Lakeside High School to ask my classmates, well, if you don't want to see Grand Funk Railroad and Fleetwood Mac, who do you want to see? And I remember handing out ballots in my homeroom. And the top three vote getters were Chicago, Transit Authority, Blood, Sweat, Tears, and Joe Cocker. That's who they said, Murray, if you can get them, that's who we will pay you $3 to see. Go get Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Joe Cocker.
So you did market research after the fact.
Yes. So I called New York, and New York said, no. We're not sending you anybody until you pay the last guys we sent. And besides, those people are not available.
What was that guy's name again?
Joe Lambusta.
Oh, my God.
Lambusta.
What was...
I still had the contracts.
Wow. That's amazing. So, well, I mean, that's, since you do have some intimate knowledge of Fleetwood Mac and Grand Funk Railroad, what do you remember about them as artists at that show? What do you remember about them personally in that hour? Or were you just so, is it a blur?
Well, no, I remember it vividly because Fleetwood Mac was a five-man blues band headed by Peter Green. And Peter Green was horribly addicted to... LSD. And in fact, would very shortly after he played this show, would leave the band and was institutionalized. And Peter, while he was in residence at my house, was working on a song that showed you the problem that he was having.
I see.
And I would listen. He would be locked in my room, and he would be playing the guitar, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. I couldn't understand the words he was saying because he was singing about a green Manalishi. And I thought it was a green Maserati, a green spaghetti. I didn't know what a Manalishi was. And he said, there was a green Manalishi with a three-pronged crown, da 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 da. And I'm listening to him work out the song, and I went to Mick Fleetwood, and I said, Peter won't come out of my room. And he said, Peter. And I said, well, I'm worried about my tropical fish, and I need to feed my guppies. And he said, yeah. But I said, he's saying weird things. And it turns out Green Manalishi was a big hit for Fleetwood Mac in 70, and it was... The Green Manalishi is a dog-shaped creature, and it represents greed. Basically, money. And Peter Green was caught up with the music business and what it would do to people.
Sure.
And so he had this vision of this thing that was pursuing him. Sure. It was dogging him, if you will.
Right.
And he was writing Green Manalishi at the time. And it's still, you can dial it up on YouTube and hear Fleetwood Mac play the song that he wrote while he was hanging out in my bedroom.
That is so amazing, dude. How was the show though? Was it a great show?
Well, I'll tell you what was bizarre is that the band was in the process of breaking up because Jeremy Spencer shortly thereafter disappeared with a group of hippies called the Children of God. He left the band, got on a bus with these Jesus freaks, and disappeared to South America. So Jeremy Spencer
The Atlanta show was one of the last dates he ever played. Peter Green gets sick and goes into the joint. Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, who were the bass and drum, they were the band, really. It was their band, and you could tell that. But the fascinating, I remember, the thing about Mick Fleetwood, he's like 9 feet tall.
He is.
And he weighed about 50 pounds.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, but the thing about him was this. He used to, and he wore this for many years, he used to wear bollocks. He had a leather belt, and at the end of the leather belt, there were these two big bollocks. They were like acrylic or something, and they would hang down right where his would be, and he wore this on stage for years and years and years and years and years, the bollocks. And I remember, you know, bringing them home, and I knew that my mother was going to just absolutely freak out. But as my mother said to me, we can't adopt these boys. What are we going to do with them? But I remember Mick Fleetwood and his bollocks. It was a singular thing. And
was it? I mean, was it an artist kind of like statement, or was he into S&M or what?
Mick, oddly enough, was in love with Jenny Boyd's sister. Jenny was married to George Harrison. And Mick later married that girl, and so that's how he and Harrison are related, the Boyd sisters. George Harrison met her on the set of Hard Day's Night, and the Boyd sisters were famous model types, and Mick married a sister. So, but I remember the thing, too, about him is he was heavy into oils. Scented oils. Mm-hmm. He always smelled divine, but it was patchouli, you know. And I remember he was into oils long before anybody else got into oils. And in fact, to this day, he still loves to do the oil alchemy. And I remember a few years ago when he was on one of the hiatuses, he started an auction company called Fleetwood Owen, and he wanted to specialize in rock and roll memorabilia. And I called Fleetwood Owen and said, "Yeah, I have a poster I want to sell." And they said, "What is it?" I said, "Well, it's the first Fleetwood Mac concert in the United States. It's Atlanta, 1969. And they said, "One minute, please." Mick picks up the phone. He said, "Who is this?" I said, "This is Murray." So he goes, "I remember you." He said, "What have you got?" I said, "Well, I have a poster from that show." He goes, "Well, it's mine." He said, "I have the world's largest collection of my band's own memorabilia." He said, "I want that poster."
Yeah.
He said, "How much do you want for it?" I said, "Well, I think this poster is easily 10 grand. He goes, "Well, you're going to have to give me some time to get the money." He said, "I don't have 10 grand." He said, "But you can't, don't sell that poster." I still have the poster because I'm waiting to deliver it to him in person when I see him. I have only the one, but it's Fleetwood Mac, Atlanta, Georgia, 1969.
It's amazing. Now, what about the Grand Funk Railroad side of that, though? I mean... Because that was one of the some of the first albums I bought as a kid in the 70s at garage sales. So
yeah, well, they were a power trio, and the thing about it was they literally blew the roof off of the place. I didn't think the three people could do that. I mean, a bass, a guitar, and a drum, and they blew the roof off of the place. But the reason I don't
did
have
they
much,
did they open or
oh they closed
okay.
But the thing was their manager came into the ticket office, and he took all of the money that I had. He didn't ask me. He just took all the money out of the box, and he was pissed that I didn't have all of it. But he confiscated all the receipts, and that was the end of my connection to them. I didn't even ask him for autographs. But when Mick came into Mick comes in a few minutes later, he goes, "Yeah, I'm here for our money." And I went, I started crying. I didn't know what it is. I said, that big guy took all the money. And he goes, I see.
Wow. So yeah, the Grand Funk Railroad didn't spend the night in your room.
No.
And murdered.
They got on down the road. Fish,
right.
No.
Now, I just have to ask because it's, I think it's funny. I mean, obviously your parents rolled with the punches and were colorful and eclectic, but I mean, how did you make the announcement to them that this band was coming to spend the night? And how long did they stay with you?
Well, here's the thing. My father came over, you know, naturally to check on me, see how the gig is going, you know. And he's standing there when all this is going down. And he said, "Well, look, I don't have any money to give him." He said, "Sunday night, what am I going to do?" I said, "I don't know what we're going to do." And my father said, "Well, you got us into this. What are you going to do?" So the thing that I did was I went back to Lakeside High School that same week, and I told my classmates that, my next show, Chicago Transit Authority, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Joe Cocker. Special opening act, Fleetwood Mac. Tickets, $3 in the lunchroom. And I sold 2,000 tickets
every last student and teacher in that school bought tickets to a show that I actually didn't have booked. I mean, I did not actually have those people contracted. But since that's who they you told me they wanted me to see, I said, yeah. So I sold tickets to a show that didn't exist, and all I had was Fleetwood Mac. So the next Sunday, I got some local bands to fill in to make a show out of it, and brought Fleetwood Mac on. And here's the thing. It was a Sunday night.
Okay.
And in Atlanta at the time, there was a curfew on the school night.
Uh-huh, okay.
And kids had to be home by 11.
11, okay.
You couldn't be out on the streets of Atlanta.
Yeah, we had that too.
Well, so what I did was I bring Fleetwood Mac on around 8:30, and they played, and literally it remains to this day one of the greatest concerts I ever saw. They blew the roof off of the place for 2 hours, but then I noticed that as it got to be 10:30, the audience starts thinning out because kids are going to go home.
Yeah.
And by 10:30, the place is empty. Uh-huh. Now, they're furious with me because they didn't get to see Chicago or Blood, Sweat, or Joe Cocker. And in fact, much earlier in the night, I had disappeared and I was hiding backstage. And they are furious.
Right.
Because they haven't gotten their $3 worth. They are furious. But by 10:30, the place is emptied out. Fleetwood Mac ends the show. I pay them. They go down the road. I'm golden. And I go home and tell my father that the catastrophe has been averted and everything is good now. And I had enough money for fish food. And the next day, I tell my father that I don't think I'm going to go to school today. I think I'm going to just phone this one in. I'm a little tired. And he goes, no, I don't know, you know, what you've done, but you're going to go to school today, even if I have to drive you. I said, you know, Dad, I really don't want to go today.
I may not live.
But my father drove me to school, and I told him on the way, I said, Dad, there's going to be some, you know, chances there's going to be some mad kids when I get there. He said, okay. We drive up in front of Lakeside High School, and there are 2,000 kids waiting out front for me. I didn't get off of the bus I normally ride, and they're waiting, 2,000 are waiting out front for me to come to school.
What?
And before my father can stop the car, they're piling on the hood and the trunk and the roof, and they're beating on, we want our money! We didn't get to see Joe Cocker! We didn't see Fleetwood Mac! We saw us, we went back, we want our $3! And my father blows the horn. They scatter. My father gets out of the car, and in a voice that impressed Martin Luther King, says to them, and he screams, I'm shocked that you're acting this way. He said, my son busted his ass to give you this terrific thing. It's $3 to see this music thing. It is a terrific show. And if any of you think that you didn't get your money's worth, you write your name down on a piece of paper, you give the money, and I'll see that you get your $3 back. He said, but quite frankly, I'm shocked that you're acting this way. You all ought to be ashamed of yourselves. And the whole crowd is going, Out of the back of the crowd, One of my classmates says, yeah, it's not Murray's fault. You missed the show. And some of the kids turned and said, what? And my friend Buzzy said, yeah, you babies had to go home for curfew. You missed it. After Fleetwood Mac played, Chicago came out and played, man. You missed it. You had to go home. And after Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears came, they jammed together. Oh, Joe Cocker, he was drunk, but he still sang a few songs. And people go, oh, that's booked. They said, no, I was there. I saw it. Y'all had to go home for curfew. I was there, man. You missed it. And at that precise moment, the bell to homeroom rings. Everybody's going inside. And people are going, did you see anybody? Did you see Chicago? And people are going, yeah, man. You didn't stick around? So by the end of the day, half of the student body was talking about a concert they had not seen.
Wow.
Because it wasn't cool to admit that you had to go home.
No, absolutely.
And by the end of the week, there was no one left to ask for their money back. You didn't want to admit that you had missed a show of the year. And by then, the details had been filled in as to what Joe Cocker was wearing and what Chicago did. And there were people who just took this, and I didn't say a word. But the most bizarre thing was that 40 years later at my class reunion, my classmates were coming up to me going, Silver, you know, those shows that you used to do, man. I tell my kids and my grandkids
of the shows that you used to bring and the people that we saw. And they can't believe it when I tell them that we saw Fleetwood Mac and Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Joe Cocker and Chicago Transit Authority. And I'm saying to myself, yeah, I can't believe it either. But in any event, they're still having false memories after 40 years of shows that never happened.
Wow.
But those were the days. And you could get away with that sort of thing. You can't do that now, but... That was 1969.
Yeah, I think some human nature is still the same, but I know what you mean, especially and then you know, when you're peer pressure, you know, in that kid phase.
Well, I'll tell you how I made it up to my classmates. I brought Ted Nugent and the Amboy Dukes to our graduation dance.
No kidding.
And I brought the Allman Brothers with Dwayne Allman to our prom.
Wow.
And I made it up.
Yeah, I guess so.
Dwayne Allman.
Yeah.
Allman Brothers.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah.
Now buried in Rose Hill. Right? Yeah, exactly.
Allman Brothers.
Woo! So, in that, I definitely get a sense that your father was very supportive. At the same time, he wanted you to kind of face adversity, you know, face your mistakes and take responsibility and, you know...
Well, my father had been through a tremendous amount in his life, and he figured there's no way that he's going to shield me from it. But the thing was, my father was not afraid to set me up to fail.
Mm-hmm.
He was not, because my father was more concerned that I got up and off the sofa and played the game. In fact, when I was a little boy, my daddy was my little league baseball coach. My father didn't want me sitting on the bench. He wanted me to play the game, even if he had to be the coach. And to his credit, my father put me in the game.
Mm-hmm.
He sent me to law school. He put me to work in his law firm. And if I came to my father and said, I want to fly to the moon, he'd say, how much is the ticket? My father would enable me in any way that he could. And he never made the judgment, well, this ain't going to work or this ain't. And I'll tell you something else about my old man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in senior year law school that he's paid to put me through.
Now, where was that?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
And I'm working in my dad's office during the day, and I'm going to law school at night. And my senior year, I go to my father and say, I need to take a leave of absence. He said, for what? I said, I want to write a book. I said, you know, I've always wanted to write a book. I got a chance to write a book. I'd like to write this one. He said, what is this book? I said, well, I want to write a book about Jerry Lee Lewis. He said, okay. And he continued to pay me my salary.
Mm-hmm.
I took a 90-day leave of absence from the firm. I never went back. The book turned into Great Balls of Fire, and the book turned into the movie. And I went back to my father and said, you know, I'd much rather do this than do what you do. And he said, I don't blame you.
Yeah.
And my father never said, you know, I just squandered a lot of money on an education. And I just – no. My father said, that's what you want to do, do it.
Yeah, he could have said that other stuff.
He said, look, that's what you want to do, do it. And he supported me in everything I wanted to do. My father never said, no, don't do that. No, don't do that. No, you don't want to do that. My father was always my coach. He was always my mentor. He was always my partner. And he never worried about win or lose. It's how you play the game. And I will say that to tell you this. When I lost the election for mayor of Savannah, Georgia, just a few weeks ago, November, my father was standing with me as he watched the results came in. And what does he say to me on his way out the door? Doesn't matter if you win or lose. It's how you play the game, and I'm proud of you.
Yeah, man. I agree with that.
My father said to me.
And would you say that some of that attitude came from his father, Bo Peep?
Well, my grandfather was a bookie, and my grandfather would take bets on sporting propositions. And he didn't care who won or lost. He would make money from the VIG. He didn't care who you bet on. He didn't lose.
Right.
You understand? A bookie makes money because you pay him to take the bet. For example, you want to bet $100 on the Yankees to win the next game, you've got to pay my grandfather $110. He puts the $10 in his pocket. He is able to move that $100 bet to somebody with more money than him.
Yeah.
And so what happens then is, it doesn't matter if the Yankees win or lose, he calls the people that he's moved the bet off to. They pay off or don't, as the case, and he keeps the VIG. He doesn't care who wins or loses. He just takes the bets.
Uh-huh.
So my grandfather didn't care. You know, he didn't care who won the game. He's making money either way.
Right.
So he was one of these guys who thought, you know, it doesn't matter win or lose. What matters is who makes the money. And he made a fortune at a time when it was hard to make a buck in this town.
Yes.
He made an ocean of money.
Yes, he did, or I understand that he did. So your father was obviously... is was a friend and a hero and a disciplinarian. How was the what was the balance like with your mother? She obviously talked to you about your psychic stuff, and so that was definitely a support. You had quite a support team, didn't you?
My mother was artist. My mother was an artist. In fact, she was in art school when she was expecting me. And my mother instilled in me the appreciation for all the fine things in life. My mother was also a piano player. She played classical music at home whenever she wasn't doing anything else. And so my mother was all about art and music. And my mother was 21 years old when I was born. She didn't know anything about babies, especially boy babies, because she was an only child. And my father was the first boy she ever knew. And she was a virgin on her wedding night. And my mother and my father are still together after 65 years.
Yeah, amazing.
Bottom line is, my mother didn't know anything about little boys. She didn't know anything about babies. And I remember the story was told that after 10 days in the hospital, my mother came home and had to ask a friend how to give a baby a bath because she did not know which end to powder. But my mother was not so much a playmate for me, but my mother was a great teacher. She was a librarian. And my mother would, whenever she had time, she wouldn't play. My mother would be reading a book. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't tell me to read. She showed me by enjoying books that this was something that you do. And so as a little boy, I had a reverence for books. I had a love of music. And my mother instilled in me an appreciation for art. That's what hung on the wall was reproductions of Renoirs and so forth that I thought were real. But in any event, that's what the house was filled with. It was filled with music and art. And that's what I think made the difference.
Wow. And she also grew up in Savannah?
Did.
What neighborhood?
31st and Bull, across the street from Gottlieb's.
That house.
And it's now an empty lot, a parking lot for the church.
Amazing.
This was the Eicholtz family that begat Eicholtz Realty, which begat Dickie Mopper.
Uh-huh.
Dickie Mopper's grandmother and my great-grandmother, the same woman.
Wow.
And she was a Raskin. Related to Alex.
Hello.
We're all related. Go figure.
Yes. That Savannah, what is it? What do you say? The 0 degrees of separation?
I got news for you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had Murray for nearly a luxurious hour, and it's been a real pleasure to have him share his stories and memories of Savannah, rock and roll. And we're going to do more with him down the road, but is there anything that you wanted to plug as far as your website?
Well, I don't have one that is current. I mean, I've dismantled my political website, which had 150,000 followers.
Sure.
But right now I've gone back to my professional love as a writer. I'm working on 4 books at the moment.
Okay.
4 at the same time. And I'm confident that one of them is going to be a movie.
Okay. Well, we won't ask you too much right now, but just as a storyteller, tour guide here in Savannah, Georgia, everybody, I continually, constantly promote Murray's book, Behind the Moss Curtain. It's such an interesting compendium of all this stuff that we've talked about in a way today, very Savannah-centric and also amazing ties and unexpected connections to the world out there in that book, Behind the Moss Curtain. He also is the author of When Elvis Meets the Dalai Lama. Did I say that right?
It's my memoir.
Your memoir. And that's an amazing book about a lot of the rock and roll stuff and just big personalities in Hollywood and all kinds of things there. Very spiritual book as well. And of course, yes, most infamously known for the Great Balls of Fire book with Myra, Jerry Lee's childhood bride at one time, and now ex, right? They're no longer married. But the unauthorized biography?
No, this was the authorized. It was the uncensored story of Jerry Lee Lewis.
The uncensored story of Jerry Lee Lewis, and of course that did become the movie with Dennis Quaid as Jerry Lee and Winona Ryder in a great role. She looked every bit 13 in that movie.
Well, she was 16.
Was she 16 when she played that?
And had a hard time playing a 13-year-old.
Yeah, she's pretty mature too.
But I got to tell you, Shannon, the reason I am not a tour guide in Savannah, Georgia is because you're much better at it.
Ah, thank you.
If I could do anything in this world, I would do tours of Bonaventure Cemetery. But after taking yours,
yes.
Well, unimprovable.
Thanks, man.
You are the best show I've ever seen in or out of a cemetery. And people, if you haven't taken Shannon's tour, if it's not as good as I say it is, I'll give you your money back.
Oh, I love that. That's a great plug from Murray Silver Jr. Heard it, everybody. Definitely check out his books on Amazon.com and other places. And because there is so much to Murray Silver is to demystify, dissect, and delayer, we're going to have him back real soon for part 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Because we have a lot more to get into. He is one of my favorite personalities in the world. So thanks for joining us here on Sixth Sense World Radio. And I'm your host of Truth Seeker Radio, Shannon Scott. And look forward to having you back for future episodes. Please check me out at shannonscott.com. I'm under Shannon Spencer Scott on Facebook. And be sure to come out and take my tours with Sixth Sense World via Bonaventure Cemetery Tours. And, of course, there's a website of that same name, bonaventurecemeterytours.com. So thank you, everyone. It's been a great time.
Seen anything interesting out there?